In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Together, O Mary, bright dawn of the new world, Mother of the living, to you do we entrust the cause of life. Look down, O Mother, upon the vast numbers of babies not allowed to be born, of the poor whose lives are made difficult, of men and women who are victims of brutal violence, of the elderly and the sick killed by indifference or out of misguided mercy. Grant that all who believe in your Son may proclaim the gospel of life with honesty and love to the people of our time. Obtain for them the grace to accept that gospel, the gift ever new, the joy of celebrating with gratitude throughout their lives, and the courage to bear witness to it resolutely, in order to build, together with all people of goodwill, the civilization of truth and love, to the praise and glory of God, the Creator and Lover of life. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. If everyone has the sheet, we're going to try to go to about 4:20, 4:30, and then we'll go upstairs for adoration of Blessed Sacrament, and then after that we'll get a bite to eat and come back here. But so between now and 4:20, 4:30, we're going to keep you busy. we know more about life now than they knew in the past. And it's amazing, we seem to disrespect it the more we know about it. But I don't know if you heard the story, some of you have, of there was a couple in this old ancient town many, many years ago, in the Middle Ages. And this young girl, she was a very polite young girl, she came from a very polite young family. And there was a young fellow too that was from an equally polite family. And the people in the town thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if those two someday fell in love? So they grew up, and lo and behold, they did, and they married. And the whole town rejoiced, because the polite young man was marrying the polite young woman. And the town began to hope that maybe God would send them a child. And so they were waiting. Finally, the news went forth that she was with child. And the whole town rejoiced, because the polite young woman and a polite young man were now going to have a baby. So they waited. Everybody practically stopped working in the 8th month waiting for this birth. And the 9th month came, and there was no delivery. Everybody's waiting. And the 10th month came, and there was no delivery. The whole town's beginning to wonder. And the town was really, they weren't doing the jobs, and so everybody had stopped. And with the 11th and 12th month, no delivery. They waited another year, and there was no delivery. So the whole town started, well, we got to get back to work. You think, what's going on? And you know, there was never delivery. The child was never born. Everybody had to go back to work. And eventually, the old couple grew old, and he died, and eventually she died. And some of the old people in that town, for them it was a mystery. What was this? And so when she died, they decided, we've got to find out what happened. So they did an autopsy. And it was unbelievable. When they opened up the womb, guess what they found? For this polite young woman who married the polite young man, they found twins. And inside was an old man with a long white beard. And alongside him there was an old man with a long white beard. And each one was saying to the other, after you, after you, after you, after you. If you're polite in our society, you never get born. The reality is that we do know an awful lot more about the about life in the womb, and God, it's treated by those in authority with such disrespect. With the financial difficulties we're having, it's not that you can't find a car. Okay, the financial difficulties we have today is the car dealers are making cars, but no one's buying them. The General Motors is going, all of them. It's not that you can't buy a car. There's loads of cars. Everybody's starting stuff because nobody's buying. Now, basically, that's the approach of the helpers. Let them change any laws they want. But if we and let them have all types of suppliers, but if we dry up the demand, if we change hearts, if we change it that no one wants an abortion, no one's buying the rotten product, you see, the law means nothing, right? And so what we have to do at this point is, so to speak, to outfox them. In other words, we're not going to spend our time, 90% of our time, as so often happens, trying to change the law. Elect politicians who go right into this culture and you lose them. See? With the helpers, as you know, 90% of our time is spent in changing the culture. It's not in changing the law. See? And the rest will follow. So that our Holy Father, in the encyclical Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life, he said, I give you a mandate. I tell you no longer simply to protect life. You're in a culture of death. I give you a mandate. Go out and promote a new culture of life. Proclaim the gospel. Proclaim the gospel of life. And that's really what it's about right now. It's not. It's going out and a movement from the streets. That's what it is. It's a movement from the streets, and it is happening across the country, and I got to tell you, all over the world. I just got a phone call from the helpers in Salinas, California. We just sent them 50 prayer books for that group. Right? And they just sent me back, thank you for the prayer books, but yesterday the abortion clinic closed forever. They went there for many years. Okay? They were there many years. But I'm getting that again and again and again. Okay? That's a very interesting thing, see? So that it does make a difference that we have this movement. And when I went to Sydney, Australia for the World Youth Day, the main abortion mill that I went to more than 10, 15, 12 years ago, it closed. And I was there for the anniversary of the close. It just closed recently, okay? But that is happening. It's not just turnarounds we're getting now. We're getting closure. And that also is involved too, that they're trying to force doctors to perform abortions. Why? Because doctors won't. That's why. In other words, that's what they're trying to remove the law now, to make the doctors, Catholic doctors, not just Catholic doctors, they want to make all doctors perform abortions, because they are having difficulty now getting abortion providers. So we're winning. That's the thing to keep in mind, okay? So that is the thing I would just preface the remarks with. Now, what I want to center in upon today is after a large prayer vigil, what do? You have what we call a prayerful presence and counseling. My brother didn't know how to play golf, and I explained to him how to play golf, and he couldn't beat me. But after a while, he started to study how to play golf. I was just going on, instinct. Good athlete, do what I have to do. But he started to study all the different techniques in the matter, you see? In other words, he started to realize, well, when you have a downhill lie, where do you put the club, where do you put your feet, when you have an uphill, when you go into the sand, what do you do? And he started to study all the various techniques and signs of golf, and now I can't touch him. I can't touch him. He's a very good golfer, you see? I mean, he shoots in the 70s, okay? Which is very good, you know. See? I shoot in the 90s when I was golfing, but that's he gives me strokes now. This has been part of the thing. But he took time out, not just, see, in other words, I go and I play golf. See, it's for me, it's okay, fine. But I don't go into finding out the study, the techniques, the means of really improving myself out there. See? So, what we're talking about today, when we talk about to learn the techniques, to learn the means of it, is the science, the art, okay? And the same thing is true with the cyber counseling. With cyber counseling, we can counsel for many years, and God blesses us, and it is effective and so forth. But we also can keep trying to study how to improve being a cyber counselor. How to improve, what techniques, what makes it work? What makes it work? Okay? That's important. So this afternoon, what I'm going to try to do is give you, when I was first sent to teach, which was about, I hate to say it, I guess about 45 years ago, so you see, I can't believe it. But It was. So when I was first sent to teach, I was shocked because I was a parish priest. So I was enjoying parish life, and I wanted to teach religion in the seminary. This was okay, in the seminary, and they said no. I said, "What else would you like to teach?" Well, I said, "This is no." See, and I said, "All right, I give up. What do you want me to teach?" And they said, "Well, why don't you go get a master's degree in Latin and Greek? We want you to teach the classics." I said, "What?" Because at that point, you see, you're taking these relevant courses. See, everybody's taking relevant courses. I had to take courses that were not relevant. Right? Well, thanks be to God, I took the non-relative courses. Because right? The fellows that got a master's in the religion, by the time they got their degree, the books that they had studied were all already obsolete. Right? And it goes in and out, whereas you learn the classics, okay, it doesn't go obsolete. Now, one of the reasons I mentioned that is one of the things I had to learn was the art of rhetoric. And rhetoric is, the difference is if you write something and a person can reread it, you write that differently than if a person doesn't have a chance to read it again. When you're on the sidewalk, you are writing, so to speak, oral composition. What does that mean? It means the person only has one chance to hear you. After that, it's finished. They can't reread it. So you have to know, as the speakers in the past, what is it that enables a person to... how do you communicate? How do you affect the person? So we're going to spend a bit of time and trying to... we're going to give you the pamphlets that we give out. And I'm going to do rhetorical analysis of the pamphlet, see, and how, what you're trying to do and how to improve it. See? That's the first thing. The second thing, of course, is in the process here of when you have finished your oratory, written oral composition, the delivery, how you deliver it. So we're going to talk about how you approach, how you speak, and so forth, what movements, etc., how that can help you or not help you. It can be an obstacle to you. Now, with the helpers, when we think of sidewalk counseling, it's different. A sidewalk counselor is about as effective as his prayers. We go hand in glove. That's what makes a difference. Almost the ideal thing at an abortion clinic would be two prayers and two counselors. But we need both. We need both. Because what we're dealing with here is something profoundly different. Our Lord said that unless, you know, the branches in the vine, it dies. And without me, you can do nothing. This is supernatural work. Right? And so when a speaker is going to speak to a group, the speaker takes into account the audience. He must. As does the audience take into account the speaker. In other words, if the speaker is communicating with you, is gentle, is pleasant, cheerful, you're likely to listen. If he's nasty or mean, you're going to shut him down. See, that's a reality, you see? If you are relaxed, as opposed to being tense, the other person can be relaxed. You get tense, they get tense. See? In other words, the delivery is very important, and what is the thinking behind the person, you see? So you have to figure out, what is your audience? What is your audience? Is your audience disposed to what you're going to speak? So, for example, if they're not, well, that's basically why you need the prayer. Especially we need prayers because you're asking for, in many cases, a moral conversion. You're asking for somebody to do something that's radically difficult. It's not easy to say, keep your child. So it's easy to say that. See, but to keep your child in a situation where you're not married, you're alone, you have abuse coming a thousand different ways, you don't know how you're going to afford the child. I'm asking the person to practice heroic virtue. That's what I'm asking. Right? So we just can't say, oh, keep your child. How could you kill the child? Well, it's not that simple. It's not that simple. And you have to have that empathy, that understanding of what you're saying to the person who is coming. See? Now, so the prayer is vitally important to give the person really courage, to give the person conversion of heart, to open up the person to be willing to make the sacrifice. Right? Now, I call a prayerful presence. There are many, many types of presence. You're present to me, I am to you. We see there's a group here. But if you are praying, it makes people think of the presence of God. Very important. See, we've forgotten all about this. You know, my body, my choice. We've forgotten that the child belongs to God. And because it belongs to God, it's precious. It's precious because it's God's precious infant. And everyone is sacred. Everyone is sacred. There's no such thing as another child. No. Every child requires a special act of creation on the part of God. Every child. So there's no such thing as just another child. Okay? Every child requires a special act of creation on the part of God. Okay? So what you're doing here is the child. We have some more seats up here now. There are seats up here too. We have actually four seats up here. Okay, right here. Okay. No problem. Great. That's okay. He's good. So when people say to me, "Oh, I'm only going to pray," it drives me crazy. Okay, and prayer is the most important aspect of this whole thing. It's the most important aspect when you understand what you're asking, what you're involved in. Right? So the purpose of prayer then, first of all, a prayerful presence makes present to the person coming God, but it only makes present to the people coming God if they see you praying. So what we try to do is this: we have the helpless prayer book that enables people to focus and not to be chatting and talking. I know this is difficult, but I tell people all over the world, the ideal thing is this: depending on how long you're out there, it becomes very difficult to be silent all that time. Okay, absolutely. But what you have to do is discipline yourself when you want to get a cup of coffee, you want to take a break, to take the break. Maybe with one of the people, go for a walk, go across the street, down the block, whatever you want to do, and come back, chat, talk, but come back. But leave just one or two persons there, if you have to, that are praying. So when somebody comes, they see somebody praying. It's almost like you create an atmosphere outside of an intensive care unit, an atmosphere, say, at a wake, because it is serious. So if you are praying, you're praying for a long period of time, and you finally want to take a break, I understand that, okay? But I'm saying, but if you would, it's good to take the break, take a walk, walk down the block, get a cup of coffee, three, just leave one or two people there who continue to pray, because everybody that comes is important. And if a person comes earlier and everybody's praying, she's moved by that, but then someone comes a little bit later and the people are laughing and chatting, we have made her to be less. Okay, we have made her to be less. So this is very important. Now, when you pray, what I suggest is that sometimes you have a police barrier. It makes what we call a prayer pen. But if you do pray, what we do is you can pray in such a manner that you make yourself like into a circle, or if you like a parallelogram, if you're really into geometry, you can use a trapezoid, whatever you want, you see. But the idea is you're turning in on each other, you see, and you're praying. So people come, they pray. When the people are praying the way of the cross, it's so powerful. Because the way of the cross, they're praying out there on the sidewalk, all of a sudden everybody genuflex up, you know? We adore the Lord Christ and we praise thee. You see? It's just absolutely amazing, see? That way it comes. So the prayerful presence is vitally important. Now, why are you praying? That's important too. You're not praying primarily to save the life of a baby. You're not. Get that out of your head. You are not. You're praying for the same reason Jesus prayed at Golgotha. Salvation of souls. And what are you trying to make present at this site? Okay, what are you trying to make present? At this site, you're trying to make present what? The media loves to do this. The media loves to have two sides. Pro-life, anti-life. And we start to slip into that. I'm pro-life. You're anti-life. No. No. Get that out of your mentality. Move it. When God took flesh, the Son of God took flesh, the person Jesus Christ, He came into a world that was broken, the whole world, broken, helpless. And he came into a world that was, so to speak, the enemy of God. We had wandered away from God. And so what happens is this, is that he comes in and he gives us, he manifests to us God's love. And the God's love is a merciful love because we were sinners. People say, for example, I did this wrong, could God forgive me? Could God forgive me? Well, that's not the right question. Because the reality is this, God is not yesterday, no tomorrow, and changing back and forth. God is an everlasting now. God loves us because he created us. He loves us because he redeemed us, and he never ever stops loving us. We stop loving God. God never stops loving us. Very, very important to understand that. You see? In other words, God's love is such that you don't have to convince God to love you again. Because God never stopped loving you. It is we who stop loving God. It is we who turn away from God. When we turn back to God, there's no words needed. Now, our Lord tried to explain it very simple. He said a father had a son. He went out, he spent everything, he came back. He said, how can I convince my father to love me again? And the father went out running, embraced him, threw a party for him. Because he never stopped loving him. He never stopped loving him. So you are called to make present this unconditional, everlasting love of God at the site, at Calvary. That's what Jesus did. Peter didn't understand that. They're going to kill you. I know, but the person who's going to kill me is what I'm dying for. Because I'm going to manifest to them, I'm going to bring to them this everlasting, unconditional love of God. It's an incredible challenge. It's called loving your enemies. And it's the only thing that changes the world, is a love that is of God. A love that is unconditional. We don't say, oh, because he's nice, I will love him. No, I love him in spite of him being rotten. And that's the only thing that will change a person who stopped being rotten. When you come to darkness, you could spend the whole day there cursing in righteousness, the darkness, these evil people, etc., etc. Waste your time. Waste your time. Or you could put on the light and there's no more darkness. Or where there is hate, you bring love. Where there is hopelessness, you bring, and despair, you bring hope. Whereas you are called to be a Christian. You are called to continue the work of Jesus Christ. Now, the reality is this, is that Jesus, in his physical body, he went to Calvary, and he made present to the world this unconditional, everlasting love of God to where there's broken and in need. That's our challenge. I say to people often, when God came into the world, he asked Mary for two permissions. The first was the permission to take flesh. And she said yes. And the word took flesh in Mary. And the second permission he asked of Mary was, will you give me to the world? And she said yes, even to Calvary. Now, those two permissions God asked of you and of me. Fact. He says, first, may I live within you. You say yes. It's called Holy Communion. And then he says, now that you have received me, now I have already lived the sacrifice. It's your turn now to live the sacrifice, to be a victim with Christ. That's what it means to be pro-life, to be a victim with Christ. You now must go out to Calvary, where innocent blood is being shed, to the people who, where the culture of death is midnight, where all of these laws have its consequence, where the children are torn apart and the mothers are being exploited and pain and suffering flows from it. I want you to turn it to a place of resurrection. Oh Lord, there's dangers out there. I know. I was there before. They killed me. But I will be with you until the end of the world. You're not doing it. I am going to do it through you. I will live in you, abide in my love, and then if you love me, you will bring me to the world. You bring me to the world, most especially where it's midnight, where it's darkest, where they need my love. So you are called to continue the risen Christ in his risen body does not do the work of his Father. He does the work of his Father, which he wants to do through his mystical body, the church, through you. So you are making Christ present, and you're making Christ present in a way that he can be touched, taste, and feel the very love of God incarnate once again. People say to me often, well, Father, why don't you bring the Blessed Sacrament to the mortuary? Wouldn't that be great? And I said, there's a problem. What's the problem? I said, they don't believe. They don't believe. I said, you have to understand, it's copping out. Jesus already lived his victimhood. He lived it. It's my turn. What do you mean, Father? Well, the people, when Jesus went to Calvary, they mocked him, they scourged him, they crucified, they killed him. And all they heard was, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Right? And they saw Mary and John praying. Right? I say too often, you know, Mary, who was at the foot of the cross, is his mother. And if you don't think that Mary talked to her son at this moment, you're out of your minds. I'm sure I could tell you part of the conversation. Mary knew Jesus, her son, was a priest. And she knew this was his finest hours. She knew he was redeeming the world. And if she said anything to Jesus, she said, you stay right on that cross, son. Stay right there. You do the will of the Father. I'll pray you through it. Now, Mary wasn't on the ground screaming, yes, she was standing at the foot of the cross, says John, who was standing with her. Standing with her. You stay right there on that cross and complete the work. Right? And then it will begin. Remember John, you imagine John going, leaving Calvary and saying to Mary, well, that was a waste. Waste. You say, my son, it's only begun. He shall rise. He shall rise. Now, this is the great mystery of the pro-life movement. Great mystery is this, is that the work of the salvation of the world, the work of coming into a world that is rejecting God, that is in darkness, Jesus, through us, continues the work. You have to understand your whole life, and in particular, as a pro-lifer, in relationship, in focus to Calvary. Only a way you can understand it. Same motivation, same purpose, same reason. So when you go and I go now, you are the victim. So when they say to you, go to... See, sometimes a priest starts the day, go, good morning, Father. But often I don't get that. I'm out there in the street and they say, Father, go to hell. And I have to say to them, have a nice day too. This is the truth, you see? And because what is taking place here, okay... There are more seats, by the way. There's some seats up here, okay, and there are some seats in the retreat dining room. You can take the chairs and bring them around, okay. Now, the key is this: is that when a person curses us, rejects us, is angry with us, and we do not respond in like. They are experiencing something different. But they believed in Jesus, whom they crucified, because through it he said, Father, forgive them. And it was at the end, we're told, you know, in Matthew, the two thieves cursed Jesus. They both cursed him. And we're told in Luke, one of the thieves by the end said, I can't. You are a king. Remember me. You see? And we're told that the centurion, the soldier, it was only after he put the spear into the side of Jesus and Jesus had died that he believed. He said, truly this was the Son of God. Sometimes, let me tell you this, it takes the death of the unborn child before the mother comes to the awareness that this was a child of God and begins to change her heart. And then we must be there. See, if you are there for the salvation of souls, if you are there in love, you don't say, oh, it's too late, all the children are dying. Okay? If you do that, you see, you leave. And you say, it was a total failure. The children died. You leave. You say, no, Jesus died. He died. The greatest victory was a death. But because it was overcome by, he brought victory or life from it. The pro-life movement is part of God's eternal plan. The killing that's taking place in the world today is an incredible, great evil. No questions asked. That's the greatest evil ever took place in the face of the earth. Simple. The day we crucified our God. And that's the greatest good that ever took place in the face of the earth. The day our God was crucified. He redeemed the world. This evil, and God has permitted, and He is. He's not up in the heavens saying, oh my God, what's happening? Father, what do you think, son? What should we do? Not so. If this is part of the eternal plan, it means He can bring a greater good from it. He can have us really living as Christians, acting as Christians. He can, from this good He brings, again, we're living again the passion of Christ and the resurrection, the power of God is manifest. It all becomes a grace. Everything. Right? So that means that everybody that comes there is in need of your presence. Not just the woman. She may be the least in need of your presence. Oh, sure. Yeah. So that if you can. Okay. No problem. Okay, so well, I'll tell you what, we have two seats here. How many? Is this two people?
Three.
Okay. If there's two seats here, we'll get you another seat. Okay. There are seats, you know, in the retreat dining room. Okay. I mean, we have three seats. Right? That's it. I feel like the Yankee Stadium now. only three seats left. Now there's $600. You're buying a position. New less seats, right? That means it costs more. Okay. So the point I'm making is this: is that the spirituality of the helpers is you are there to save souls, not to save secondarily to save children. If you save the soul, you save the child. And if you don't save the soul, what happens is this: if you don't save the child and you convert the soul, that's pleasing to God. Because God may be permitting the this two seats right here, there's one over here, there's two here, one over here. Okay. Go there. Okay. God may be permitting the death of the child, okay, in His eternal plan, before the conversion of the parents take place. And it may be that they're going to have to experience the loss of the child before they come to the realization it was a child, because they're in such a state of denial. The whole society is. Right? So the first part then, the spirituality of the helpers is this: think to Calvary, mindset of Jesus Christ. You are not there to save the physical life of the baby, you're there to save souls. It means that you'll speak to them before the abortion and after the abortion. You are to make present the unconditional, everlasting love of God, loving your enemies. You are not pro-life and they're pro-death. No way. We are ambassadors of Jesus Christ. We're making present this unconditional, everlasting love of God. And we are victims with Christ. Jesus, the risen Christ, continues His work in the world today through us, His mystical body. And He gives us the strength to become victims, to live the Mass. It's nice to go to Mass, but you do have to go out and live it. Otherwise, the Mass is an empty rite. You see, the difference is this. If you read the Hebrews, there's the word Eucharist. Hebrews is all about Christ, the priest, the victim. And the word that's never mentioned in Hebrews is the word Eucharist. That's because the reality is this, that Jesus was a priest, He died and redeemed the world, and objectively the world was redeemed, period. The Mass was not necessary, the Eucharistic Mass. The Mass becomes present, and this victimhood of Jesus Christ, which gives meaning and substance to the Mass because He already did this, it's making it present, is made present for our sake, that we can unite ourselves with Jesus and give this new offering to God. But it is meaningless if Jesus didn't die on the cross. It is meaningless if there was no victim who rose from the dead. Meaningless. And it is meaningless if we offer the Mass and we are not victims with Christ in the eyes of God. It means we have to go out and live the Mass. And where you live the Mass most especially today, it's at Golgotha. It's at Calvary. It's where the innocent blood is still being shed. Women are being exploited. People are at midnight, at midday. They're in darkness in this culture of death. And we have to bring to this incredible darkness, this culture of death, the light, the truth, the love, the hope of Jesus Christ. And when we do that, we grow in holiness. We're not doing them a favor, by the way. We actually are growing and becoming holy. I see it all the time. Help us all over the world. I just admire and watch them grow as Christians and holy. I don't even know how good they are. Because they're living the Mass. And all of a sudden, they have courage. People who before were sort of embarrassed to make the sign of the cross in a restroom before eating, go like this, that I said. Now they're kneeling on the ground in a public sidewalk, in a public square. Not even worried. Right? Hey, we're getting courage. Nobody's going to stop us. You see, no one's going to stop us. We're going to make Christ known. So, the prayerful presence is incredibly important from the point of view of the conversion of heart. You have to know why you're there. You're there for the salvation of souls. You're there because you're living the Mass. You're victims with Christ. You're there to make present the unconditional, everlasting love of God to people who might consider you their enemy. Okay, the media may put us two sides. Don't get locked into that. There are no two sides. You are Christians. You are loving your enemy. When you love the enemy, you have no enemies. See, that's what the love does. It removes all within ourselves. It's no longer hate and anger. It's all gone. It's gone. Now it's your problem. It's your problem, see? And that's what God does. God loves us. And we have to make that. See, so often when a woman, has an abortion, she wonders, can God ever forgive me? Will the child ever forgive me? Of course, that's not the problem. The problem is, are you sorry? That's the problem. If you are, there's no. You don't have to convince God or even your unborn child to forgive you. The child and God will both throw a party for you. That's the fact. You see? So relax. But you need sorrow. And of course, the sorrow that you need is, of course, is beyond a sorry for the abortion. You have to have sorry for whatever brought you there. There's 10 commandments, not just one. Okay? So, besides the people praying at the site with these prayer books, right? And as I said, the point with the prayers now, we need discipline. Okay, I know if the longer you're out there, the more difficult it is. So it's good to discipline yourself to just walk away, take a break, come back. You see, if you're there for a shorter period of time, maintain the silence in prayer. And the way you do that is if you turn in on one another. So in other words, the prayers don't have to do anything. Okay, the prayers are there to pray. I remember I was at Choices one many years ago, and they were praying, a whole group of them were praying, and I arrived, it was a Saturday, I was going from spot to spot, and Emily, I guess it was, Emily came over to me, she said, Father, she said, you see that young fella in front of the door at Choices? She said, he just brought the woman inside. Go tell him to take her out. anything else you want to do? So I went over to him. I said, how could you be smoking? He said, what are you saying? I said, your child is dying. How could you be smoking? What are you talking about? I said, my God, you've got to go in and tell her. You'll help her. You want the child. You've got to, come on, throw away, get inside. See? So anyway, I got him to go in. See? Then I came over to the prayer group, and I said to the prayer group, I said, look, he just went in there. I want prayers for that fella. Well, you know what they did? They stopped all prayers, and one of the most powerful prayers outside of the abortion clinic is the Divine Mercy Chaplet. One of the most powerful prayers. I get absolutely spoiled almost every day when I say that with a particular reason. I get turned around. Okay, it's incredible. See? So I asked them, I said to them, look, will you pray? There was about 40 people in the prayer group. It was at Queens Boulevard at the time. See? They all went down on their knees, and they began the Divine Mercy Chaplet. So I'm sort of standing there. Obviously, I had a police barrier. I'm standing there, and suddenly this fella is behind me. He taps me. I turn around. I said, "I told you to go in and get her." You see? So he said, "I know." I said, "Well," he said, "here she is. She's crying. See, she's crying." See? So I started to talk to her. This is a true story. I started to talk to her, and as I'm talking to her, you wouldn't even know, another couple came out. See, it's a domino theory, you know, lemming theory. One follows the other. Another couple came out, and they brought over to me. Now I'm talking to both of them. You understand? At the same time? See? And so what happens, while I'm talking to, this is a true story, while I'm talking to both of them, another couple came out. Like three of them. I had to turn around to the prayer group, and I said, "Slow down, I can't handle this." I can't have two at a time. Three's too much. Three's too much. But my point, of course, is the power of the prayer. The prayers. You see, in other words, the helpers are effective because we are a team. We have prayers. The prayers and the team, both together. Plus, it's incredibly important to have prayers out there because counselors can be eaten up by the poor spirit. And if there's good spirit there, you go over, you're reinforced, you get good spirit, you see, it helps you to get focused again. You go over and just say some prayers with them, get back again. Very, very important. Very, very helpful. Okay? Now, the prayers, however, should not be right next to the door, right next to the people. They should be at a distance. And if you have, what we do, we have like a, we do not carry pictures and so forth for the large prayer vigil, because we're coming in prayer. But when we have the prayerful presence follow up, we do have a display, an exhibit for life that's balanced. That's balanced. It has a beautiful picture of a child, maybe a picture of a blessed lady and so forth, the fetal models, the development, and then the types of abortion. And we usually put it on the ground near where the people are praying. So people can come over, everybody's holding a sign. They come over and they look at it, they see it. And it's I call it an exhibit for life. Exhibit for life. So people can come over and look at it when they come out. And you let them go. You let them go. Let them look at this thing. See? So, but the point is, the people who are praying, we have people who are at home and they are doing the spiritual support prayer. Or we have people, wherever I go to the monasteries. I go to the contemplatives. I get them praying. I went to Dachau. What did I do? I went right to the monastery there, the Precious Blood Monastery by the sisters, it was the Carmelites. I went to Mother Superior, talked to all the sisters, 17 of them, and they are praying for the helpers all over the world. Wherever I go, I get the backup spiritual support prayers. Right? I remember there was a group of sisters over in New Jersey who wanted to be spiritual support prayers. I was speaking to the Mother Superior, and I said, "Sister, do they suffer much?" She said, "What's the madman?" She said, "Yes, Father." I said, "Wonderful." I said, "In your opinion, sister, what sister suffers the most?" And again, she's silence on the other side. What am I dealing with? A madman, yeah? And I said, she said, "I think it was Sister Mary." And I said, "Good. Give her my name. Give her my name." And what they did was they adopted by name the individual counselors. And they wrote out a form. And they would offer up their sufferings during the week. For the person can be counseled on the sidewalk on Saturday. See? So they worked as a team. Now, so it's a very good way of also getting the helpers, the counselors out there, because if on Saturday morning, you know, in February it's dark, it's snowy, and you're not going to get up, and you're going to, on Monday, you're going to call, you're going to ask the sister, she wants to know, how did we do? I have hit my pain all week. You said, "Well, it was sort of cold. I sort of turned over the bed." No, it's a great motivation to get you out, you see, and go. But this is important, to get people pray for you, with you, okay, as many as you can. We have people who make these rosary beads from all over the country, and they send it to us. And we give the rosary beads out with how to pray the rosary, okay, on the streets. But we'd ask the people this. We say to them, look, when you pray, when you're making the rosary, instead of being, again, a coffee clutch, would you use that time to pray for the person to whom those beads are going to be given? So when we give the beads out, they're already blessed. Because somebody has you in making these beads was praying. So we have a whole chain with many links. Many links. Right? And we don't know what link is the one that did it, or all of us together. It's a life link. You see, a life chain. You see? Literally. In which the people praying at the site, the counselor praying while waiting for somebody to come, the person in the bed of pain, the rosary makers, and see, the sister's here, it's so funny. The sister's here, you know, I come home. And they want to know, how did they do? And I say, do I get any credit? Hey, Father, you know, it's prayer. It's prayer. And it's right. You see, it is. That's the most basic thing. See? So, okay, so the spirituality of, it's not just important being there, it's being there with the right mind and heart. Not in self-righteousness, not there to condemn, not thinking you're better, okay? It's where you should be. You're living the Mass. It's Christ is present through you. So you have to make present yourself in such a way that they see the face of Christ in the group that's present. They see the love of God in what you say, do, and act. Okay? And it forces you then to become a Christian. That's important. See? So the prayerful presence part then is the first part I wanted to emphasize. Okay, now the art of sidewalk counseling. Okay, it is an art. It is an art. I'm going to maybe we give out these materials that we use. If you just distribute them, okay. Right. There's extra seats if you want to get one. Okay. Okay. Now, it's important that a person have some confidence, if you want, when you go out to do some sidewalk counseling, okay? What I'm trying to do is maybe to give you a wider context that you know what you're trying to do and how to do it. Okay? You remember when you were all back in English class in school, you write a composition, you have to have an introduction, a body, and a conclusion. Remember that? The sisters tell you that. So this is me. How are you? I'm coming to the end of the system. Anyway, so in a I'm going to just do a little bit of rhetoric here, okay? And then we're going to apply it to this. Okay, apply it to this. When you are going to make a presentation, the first thing you have to do before you make the point at issue, okay, the status question is the point at issue, is you have to get the goodwill, the attention, the teachableness, the docility of the people you're speaking to. Otherwise, you're speaking to yourself. Because if they're not listening, if they're not docile, if you don't have their attention, then you have what you're making a point, but it's going nowhere. It's going nowhere. They're not even listening. Okay. So the first thing that the rhetoricians would tell you is that you have to make sure in what is called the exordium. Exordium. And towards the end of the exordium, you're going to make the point at issue. You know, you used to have like a syllogism. See, a syllogism, a major, a minor, and a conclusion. Okay? In other words, you say, from the first Catalinian address, reduced to a syllogism, three lines. First is this. All traitors should be killed. Major. Minor. Catiline is a traitor. Conclusion? Catiline should be killed. That's the whole speech. Next one. Okay. Anything that a person gives, you should be able to reduce it to a syllogism. If you cannot, they're not rational. They may be moving you. It may be emotional, maybe so forth, but it's not rational. Hmm? That's right. So you have to know what is your conclusion. Hmm? What is your conclusion? Hmm? Is it keep the child? What is your conclusion? See? So, but before you come to the conclusion and you say to the person what you want them to hear, you may have a problem. And so what they have is the exordium, and then the pointed issue you stated, and then following that is your arguments for your point, okay, for the conclusion. It's called the confirmatio. See? How you argue, you make your points for it. But, and normally what you do is you refute what you anticipate in the audience is their difficulties. If the audience itself is not sympathetic, if the audience itself has antipathy to what you're going to say, you have to do the refutation first. You have to remove the barriers from them listening to what you want to say. Okay? That's just the first thing. So the thing is, if a person has they're not open to what you're going to say, for various reasons. You have to figure out what are the reasons, and I have to refute them. Now, a way of refuting something is three basic ways. It's to denial, retort, and make distinctions. Okay, it's the basic three ways. You can reduce everything to that. Okay, it's a denial. Okay? It is retort is to turn back, and to make a distinction. To make a distinction. Well, you grant something, but you see. So for the denial is one of the great lies that they are coming to the clinic with, for example, is if I have an abortion, it will bring back yesterday and I can get on with my life once again. That's the basic one. You have to know that. So you have to anticipate that very early and try to deny it. When a person is coming, I said to you, you're trying to get their goodwill, their docility, and their attention. If a person's coming, don't turn it into a shootout at the OK Corral. You remember that? You remember ever see High Noon? Okay, I'm showing my age, but High Noon. I guess it was Gary Cooper. You see, and he's waiting at midday, and the guy's coming in on the train, and then everybody's behind the shutters watching for the shootout, the OK Corral at High Noon. See? And there it is. He's with his guns, and the other guy's with his guns, and who's going to draw it? You see the whole thing. Well, sometimes the counselors make a High Noon scene outside of an abortion clinic. Here they come, here I am, you try to get by me, I got my guns, you got yours, you see, and it's got the old shootout. See? Well, you got to remove that. It's not that, okay, it's not that. So what you're doing is, usually you look pretty harmless if you put a rosy bead in your hand. Right? So counselors should have the rosy bead in their hands with the material. And the person's coming, you don't try to pick them up. Not at the door. Pick them up earlier if you can. Okay, if you can. If you're working in a team, you have two people. One's trying to pick them up earlier. If they don't get to the person, then they let them go, and the person at the door makes the last effort to try to get to them. You work as a team. The other way is reversed. The other person's picking up further, and you'll move. If you see a person stops, is talking to somebody, you move towards the door. If the other person is stopping, the person is talking to somebody, you move towards the door. You're working as a team. Keep moving. And don't go two at a time. Only one at a time to the person. One at a time. And what you're doing is this. You're not walking right up to the person. It's not in your face. Okay? What you got to do is it had like the Hill versus Colorado law in Colorado. You can't go within 8 feet. You have to stop within 8 feet of a person coming. Well, the help is we have the law 10 feet. 10 feet. In other words, you should not. The person coming by, you don't walk right up to them. Okay? It's confrontational. It's frightening. They don't know what's going on. What you do is you let them come to you. You walk and you stop maybe 10 feet from them, and you turn in such a way you give them a wide berth that they can easily walk in. You can easily walk in. No problem. They see that you're not stopping them. Okay? And then at the end you turn a little bit. Towards them. See? Now, what do you say? How do you greet them? Well, first of all, you look into their eyes. It's the window to the soul. And you smile. And I usually say, God bless you, Mom. And I don't say to them, would you take this? Because if I ask a question, there's two answers. Yes, no. I don't want no. So I have to put it in the imperative mood. But in the Yusuf, not the Yusuf, the more gentle imperative, okay? The hortatory. Mm-hmm. That type. So I'm saying to take this. It's good for you. Okay? Take this. Now what I'm doing is this. When I'm saying take this, I'm putting it into their hands while looking at their eyes. And I'm saying this, take this, Mom. This is help for you. This is help for you. Read it. Okay? Read it. Now, the woman, when she is coming, sometimes there's a fellow walking with her. And the fellow isn't always helpful, but sometimes he is. Body language you must look and observe and learn to read. It shouts louder than words. Okay, body language. Incredibly important. And you can tell after a while by body language if this fellow is going to be helpful or he's going to be a problem. You can tell by the body language whether this girl is really tough or she's overwhelmed. Whether she'd be open or she would not. Everything. Is, you know, after a while, you don't have to say anything. Everything's being said. See, by the body language. If the fellow is coming and you see him as a possible obstacle on her receiving this information, because he wants it in there, the baby out, and he's gone. So you observe that, and if he puts himself on the same side as you, because he's going to run a block, see, you stay there, but at the last minute, you see, when they're about 15 feet away, you just gently walk to the other side of the sidewalk, see, and turn again. And now suddenly you're on her side. And if he jumps in front of her, now she knows he doesn't want her to get this information. He's not there to protect her. Right? So, but it's important for you to read that. And what you do is, sometimes they take this material from them in these clinics. Okay? So you have to tell them, put this in your pocket. What we do sometimes is we say, look, they're going to take this from you. So I'll tell you what we do is, we give you one for them, and this is for you. Now, when we give the one for them, we usually take out the guts. We just give them the blue. So you have the inside part there. So what we do is we just give them the blue. It's cheaper rather than give the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So she gives that to him and puts the rest aside. Then when they take it, see, they know they were right. They weren't lying. They don't want me to have this. And you tell them, they don't want you to have this because they're going to make money on you having the abortion. Let's not kid ourselves. This is help for you. Right? So what you're doing is the person is coming and you're looking into the eyes and you're saying, Mom, God bless you, smiling at them. You take this. This is help for you. Now, I want you to have the goodwill, the docility, and the attention. That's the purpose of the exordium. Purpose of the exordium is goodwill, docility, teachableness, and attention. So how do you get the goodwill? How do you get the goodwill? Well, I usually do a simple thing as this. I say, look, Mom, I call them Mom. Chances are they are. Chances are they are. They want to tell me they're not a mother? Fine, okay. But I presume it. I presume they're not of age when they come to these places. Okay? When they come to these places. I said, Mom, look, I know no one comes here unless they have problems and the problems are real or they will not be coming here. See, that's not too condemnatory. She looks at you. Okay? In other words, I know that you don't come here unless you have problems and the problems are real. Now, what you have to do is this. I said, look, this is almost the... So I'm getting the goodwill by granting what I can, but I make a distinction. I make a distinction. And what's the distinction here? You have a problem. People come here with real problems, but there are right and wrong answers to human problems. And people, even your friends, may mean well, but they may give you the wrong answer. They'll say, take the child, take it out. It's an it until you have it in their hands. Okay? It's an it. Take it out. And I said, if they do that, Mom, if they do that, you know it's going to happen. Now, you want, when you're trying to reach people, if you use examples, it's easier for them to remember. They're just making it as well theoretical. I'll make a simple example. I said, suppose you had a fever and I gave you a glass of cold water. It would seem to remove the fever. But about 10 minutes later, the fever would be back worse than ever. If I gave you medicine, what happens is this, is the medicine doesn't seem to work. But suddenly the fever's gone. And you're feeling good. And it doesn't come back. Right and wrong answers. The right answer may not be easy. It may take time. The wrong answer may be easy and right away, but in the long run, it's hurtful. Hurtful. And I said, look, I know even your friends, meaning well, give you the wrong answer. They tell you, oh, take it out. You're too young. You're too old. You're not ready. A thousand things. Why? Hey? I said, and then you do it. And you do it. Hey? And you do it. And what happens is this. I said, the mother, and I'm talking now, all around here, I'm talking about the woman inside, not about her. Right? I'm making a distinction. I'm talking about the woman inside. The woman inside, this is why they're in here. They're pregnant, you see, this is what it is. And I said, they're told to take it out. And I said, and they will, and when the baby is removed by the abortionist from the mother's womb, when she's in the recovery room, operating room, her first reaction will be, oh, thanks be to God. Thanks be to God. My womb is empty. I moved on with my life. Finally, everything's okay. And about 10 minutes later, in that same recovery room, she's going to say, and I tell you this right now, I said, because I deal with it every day, she's going to say, oh my God, my womb is empty. And then the pain shall come to her head and to her heart. And no one will care. The fellow will not even understand. When she leaves with a broken heart. With a broken heart. You see? It's a reality. And so I said, because it's the wrong answer. It's the wrong answer. Then what you have to do is you have to... now, if you notice this material, the material is pink, blue, and white. You know why. Pink is for the girls. Blue is for the boys, you see. It's advertisement, subliminal advertisement. Okay, that's what we call it. See, they do this when you go to movies. When you're watching a movie, they're putting Coke in there. You don't even know it. So after you get a break, you go out and buy Coke. It's right. They do this. It's
popcorn
too. Yeah, I know that.
Right into the thing. Popcorn and then the Coke.
Yeah. They're both good. So what happens is this: is that the mother takes this, and what I'm dealing with now is. I'm trying to move her from, in a rapid fashion, I'm trying to move her from, first of all, the world has convinced her that it brings back yesterday, it's really nothing, she's in a state of denial, and this will solve all my problems. Right? And you're trying in a very short period of time to undo the whole false gospel of the world, which is going to destroy her. And not remove her problems. I do it every day. I see anyone's outside, and they stay long. Mike and myself, Marino, outside the abortion mill every day for long hours, and we see them before and after. I've never had a woman who came rejoicing because the baby was killed. But we do have women every day that come and say, I'm going to keep my child and smile. Every day. You see? Every day. But the people who have the abortions, I'm going to tell you something, we can't let them go. We're not Christians. We have post-abortion counseling that actually should begin immediately before all the defenses are up. They're right outside that mill every day. Right outside that mill every day. Christ should be there, touching them, opening up the possibility of coming back. You see? Very important. So what happens is this, is that the mother, I say to the mother, and this is important. Who is the audience that you're dealing with? Who is the audience that you're dealing with? The audience you're dealing with is 50% of those who come to the abortion clinic at this point, I'd say. I do know this. In every major city in the United States, 50% of the women who have abortions will have another abortion. That's a fact. It's a 50% repeat rate where God's people are not there. That repeat rate drops off radically when God's people are there. We may not stop them the first time, but we stop them the second time from coming. Okay? That's why it's so very... So the drop in abortions is not because of contraceptives that the media tries to tell you that. The drop in abortion rates throughout the United States is because God's people are outside of all these abortion mills across the country. And if we don't get them on the first shot, we are deterring them from coming back. Because this system works off repeat, repeat, repeat. We break the repeat, we're breaking into their pocketbooks. Okay? So, when the mother comes, I'm saying to you, the fact is this, that there's a 50% chance that the woman you're speaking to already had an abortion. And if you don't deal with that, you have a 70% chance of not turning her around. But if you deal with that, you have a 70% chance of keeping this next child. Very important. How do you deal with this? Well, I say to the mothers, look, now, you know, when you are trying to, if you're just giving a talk, people listen to it, and you just, well, it was entertained, they go away, but they're not going to act on it necessarily. But if you want to act on it, you have to do something different. If you're giving a talk and you're a trial lawyer, you want a verdict. You want people to act yes or no, guilty or not guilty, see? And so in the trial jury, you want the fellows, look, this man killed this woman. And see, he should be put in jail. And they're listening to the audience. But if you can bring in, so to speak, the clothes she was wearing, the blood over them, the face, this is what happens, you see? You start to get visible, right? They say, why are you doing that, Father? Because it's not simply intellectual that you're dealing with in this issue. You have to understand that it's not a matter simply of the mind, of convincing people. That's useless if you do not move their will to act on what they've heard. So, it's a couple of things here. It's not only what you say, but it's when you say it and how you say it. All vitally important. What you say, that you say in a Christ-like way, you say it meaningful. When you say it, you may have to, as I said, put the refutation before the confirmation. You may have to undo the arguments, the obstacles in her way before you make your point. Okay? But how you say it is important. What is the how? The how deals with, you're not talking to an angel. You're not talking to an animal. You're talking to a human being. And a human being has an intellect. A human being has a will. A human being has an imagination. And when you're talking to this person, you have to say it in such a way that you're not only talking about the how, you're not talking to convince them intellectually. How many people, you get up in the church and you say, the killing basis, the time we do, and you want them to come. And then the next day you're at the abortion mill and you think the whole church is coming because they applauded you. And there you are, see, with Mike Marino, myself, and a little old lady. That's it. There's no one else there. Where are all those people that were applauding? You see? They're not here. So, because there's something besides informing. That's the intellect. You must touch the will. You must be persuasive. You must move the person to act. Must move the person to act. So I'm saying to you, in a court case, if you want a verdict, innocent or guilty, okay, what you're doing is you are presenting the case, and then if you can bring in something visible, tangible, that they can see what happened. Here's her picture. This is how she looked. See, in the papers, don't they love to do that recently now? Here's this beautiful young woman before, after. Murder. Put him in jail. See? After. If you didn't see the before and after, you couldn't do it. See? That's better than 1,000 words, just the 2 pictures. You follow that? See? Now, if you say, oh, don't show the pictures of the unborn. Are you kidding me? That's like a trial case in which I'm not going to show the jury what happened. I want to act. I don't want just to be nice. I want to say, hey, you don't do that. See? I want them to be moved. No, that's going to happen again. So how do you do that? Well, we do it in here. Okay, we do it in here. Did you know? You see the did you know? Now, how you use this? I should explain it to you. And if you don't move their will, I've got news for you. They will listen politely. They'll be very gentle, very nice, but they're going to go and kill that kid very sweetly. You're going to find this out. You think, oh no, I reached them. Yes, you did, intellectually. Still going to kill the kid. Because you didn't put enough realization. You have to move the will. Persuade them strongly to act on what the knowledge they have received. That's important. See? So what happens is this. This particular thing we use, how you use it is this. I said, I have a very clever entrance to this. I usually say, did you know? Okay, this is right. Anyway, I say, did you know? Did you know? And I say, did you know that, now, this is how to use it. Did you know that this is what the children look like in the rooms of the women inside? Am I doing this now? This is the children, mothers inside, this is what the child looks like. Inside. Now talk about her inside. This is 8 to 10 weeks. 8 to 10 weeks. Now if you have a little child with you like this, a fetal model, that's 10 weeks. That's again, see, visible? See, I have it in my hand like this. I can move it around. See it looking? Interesting, see? I see that. Because they're told it's enough. It's just a blood clot. It's a nothing. Right now, they're pushing through embryo stem cell research. So they got to push through more and more and more. It's nothing. It's nothing. It's nothing. No, it's life. Human life. And it's murder. And it's going to be funded by taxpayers' money at a rate that you have never seen before. I remember the late Holy Father, John Paul II, speaking to the American bishops in November of 1998. He had them in Rome. And he said, I tell you this right now. He said the 20th century was a century of blood and tears, wars and more wars. And he said, we would hope that the 21st century would be a century of hope. He said, I tell you right now, he said to them, if you do not limit, guide, correct the revolution that's going on now in technology, in the biosciences, on human life in the womb, you see, instead of it being instead of the 21st century being a springtime of hope, it will not be a springtime of hope. It will be an age of barbarism. So far, barbarism. If you know what's going on around the world, it's barbaric. Barbaric. The British government, you know, just voted through overwhelmingly to grow life in the laboratories, human life, and to mesh it with animals, hybrids. Grow plus. It's going to be which I'm right here. But it's going to be funded. It's being funded in Britain, and it will be funded here. We're out of our minds. We don't think that this whole embryo stem cell research is not going to be growing life, experiment on life, and whatnot. It's barbaric. It's barbaric, okay? It really is. And it's a frightening. It is frightening. God's justice, you know? God, how long-suffering God is. It really is. We have to be with it. But it is difficult. But anyway, what happens is this, is that we teach, looking at this, I'm saying, the woman inside, this is what the child looks like. The child looks like. Now, you open it this way. Open it this way. You need these visible things for the world, for the world, for the world. Because you know and I know, anybody that's been outside an abortion clinic, you can speak, and they agree, and they still go in and kill the kid. Anybody that's out there, you know that happens. Because you didn't touch the will. You didn't shock them into, I can't do it. You see? I won't do it. So what happens is, you open it up and you say, you see that? I usually sort of have them laugh a bit. I say, you see that little feet there? That's 10 weeks. Replica. 10 weeks. Put the feet. That's what, and I now I switch now. Not the child in the womb, in the mother's inside. That's what my feet look like. It was. My mother had a tough time, I tell them, trying to get shoes for me. You see that? But she must have found them. And I said, she did, you see? Yeah, but it was a tough time. See? I said, that's what your feet, my feet, look. As we were in the womb beneath our mother's heart. And I'm going for the emotions. And I'm going for the guts. All right? In the heart. So I said, now I'm talking about the child in the womb, inside the mother's, inside. I'm talking about you and me and the person I'm speaking to. And I said, now, when a person is upset, you drop your voice. I remember, I used to teach young fellas, okay? And they would try to distract me. I went from Virgil, the Indian, okay? And I knew it. So I'd talk about either Yankees or life, and we go off in this fire, see? But then I'd say, okay, that's it, shut up. Okay, Father, back to work, see? As fellas, no problem. If I did that to a classroom of girls, it'd be the end of the day, the end of the year. Shut up! I couldn't do that. What? What do you mean? I mean, shut up. You see, what do you mean? What do I mean? Oh no, you said shut up. Oh, no, I said shut up. No, you didn't say. You said shut up. Oh God, what have I done? What have I done? You see? Why? The truth is this. This is the truth. I learned this. Teenage girls live 80% of their time in their feelings. It's the truth. You disturb their feelings, you've had it for the day, if not the week, if not for a lifetime. Now, teenage fellas have absolutely no feelings. This is true. I mean, you ever seen they're killing each other, and suddenly you go back later and they're hugging each other, talking like nothing happened? They're like puppy dogs fighting one another. So you go back and it's like, hey, why don't you guys just fight? What do you mean? What do you mean? Is the difference? So young fellas have to learn to get feelings, sympathy. And young women have to learn to control their feelings and use their mind, not to be made fools of. See, don't let the fellow work off your feelings, which they do all the time. They bring the girls down. All the time. You see? They bring it for an emotional ride. Emotional ride. So, what happens is this. When a person's upset, you lower your voice. And I lower my voice and I say, do you know? And I show again, you see the little child here, I said, inside, maybe 3 to 4 minutes is all it takes with a suction machine. People don't realize that. Everything's preparation afterwards. 3 or 4 minutes. They're going to go in with their suction machine, and again, just, it's about 28 times stronger than an average vacuum cleaner. And they're just going to tear that kid apart, suck it right out into the bottle, you see? And the results are going to be, well, it's going to be like this. Then you open it up. See? You open it up. Now, two doctors from Notre Dame University, Catholic doctors, tell me, Father, it's like a meat grinder. Like a meat grinder. That's what it is. Like a meat grinder, you see? And I close it again. I'm not going to get used to it. And then I say, you see the little arms here? Okay. I open it again. I point out the little arms. I said, you can still see it. I close it again. I say, see the little feet? I open it again. I said, you can still see the little feet. And then I say to him, look, no matter how difficult things are in your life, and I know they are, no matter how, don't let anyone do this to your child. See, I'm going for the verdict of innocence. I'm going for an acquittal of the unborn child. I'm pulling out all stops. That's really nice. That's a reality, okay? Now, here's my problem. 50% of the time, the woman I'm speaking to already has had the abortion. You say, well, how could you do this, Father? Cruel. You see? How could you do this? Well, I tell you this. If I don't do it, I am cruel. If I don't do it, I am weak. If I don't do it, I don't love her. Because this is what you must do. How do you handle this? Well, I say to the mothers, look, the woman inside, please God, they'll choose life. But if they do not, God doesn't stop loving them. Nor will we. When they come back out, we will approach them. We'll tell them about God's mercy and God's love. Now, once they know the truth, they have to act on the truth. You see? And then I will say to the person, look, maybe you've had a number of abortions yourself. There's light at the end of the tunnel. God's merciful. Once you know the truth, act on it. Don't go down that path again. You know how painful it is. How painful it is. And inevitably, incredibly, people will tell me about their abortions that they've had that they never told anyone. Now we're on the way for peace, for healing, opening up the way for a turnaround. Okay? A turnaround. If she's going in with a past abortion, she feels, I'm going to hell anyway, what difference does it make? I'm going to convince myself it was okay to do it the first time by doing it again. All those things are against you. So if you don't take that into account, your effectiveness is going to go down the tubes. But if you take into account and you make it known to her God's incredible mercy and love, and once sometimes we do things we don't realize it. Even if we realize it, God will forgive us. But don't continue again and again and again. You see? Now, what you have to do is this. You have to on the other hand now, the confirmatio is presenting strong arguments for your case. You have to start to build up within her an understanding, an image of the child as a blessing. because everybody's portraying the child as a curse. Everybody's portraying the child as, oh my God, it's like you got cancer. You're pregnant? My God, you see? Oh, it's only cancer. Philip, you're pregnant? You see? Is it really? Incredible. So you have to portray the child. That's the confirmatio, the strong argument. I think, look it. I know it's not easy, it's difficult, but who's going to be loving you years from now? Who's going to be loving you years from now? I said, the child will. When you're old, and who's going to be at your bedside? And you could tell stories. Okay, you could tell a bad story. I'll tell a story. My mother, okay, when she was difficulties, and you know, I tell a story. There was one time my sister Ann, she was with very high fever. We were poor. I realize it now. It's quotes poor. See, but we had by then, you know, we had coal in the furnace, you know, and wood and so forth. We didn't have any wood. So my mother said, "Well, we have to chop up the kitchen set to start the fire," right? Which we did. You see, and we had to end up sitting on the floor eating the meals the next couple of months. We got money together to get another kitchen table set, but it was worth it because of Ann. See, and Ann recovered. It was good. See? In other words, you start to tell them about yes, of course, sacrifice is difficult, but who, when at the end when my mother was dying, who was there? Ann and her six children. You see, who was there? All the children. See? And we learned about life. But what did our parents give to us? Not money. Realize now we're below the so-called poverty line, right? But we were rich because they gave us life. They gave us how to live life, wisdom, and they gave us love. And if you can give that to your child, no matter how poor you are, they are the richest of the richest children. And you can. That's within your means. Right? You can give your child life. You can give to your child how to live life. That's really important. And you can give the child your love and teach about the love of God. See? So you don't have the other means. So what? There are children that have everything, they got nothing. They're rich and they're poor. See? So that's the reality of it. So you're starting to tell them, look, I don't care if you're poor and you have to struggle. That can make you a holy person. This can make, and the child is going to be a blessing to you. So you start to build up a positive argument of, and I said, and you know, when this child is born, guess what? Everybody is going to want to hold the child. The child comes in, a little baby comes into the room. I don't even, as a priest, try to get attention. I know it's all over. It's all over. The child rules. That's God's truth. You ever see that? Oh, the little baby. You see? And those who are telling you to get an abortion, you see, they will actually be spoiling the kid because their conscience is bothering them. You got to watch it. That's the truth. But when you're holding that child, you know all the sacrifices was worth it. See, you got to paint the picture. You got to give them a different vision, different understanding. It's worth it. This is the means. You see, very, very important. With a person who has an abortion, let me just say this. The people who come back out and have the abortion, okay, we're there. When you are counseling, you counsel everybody that comes because the salvation of the souls are at risk, all of them. They're called accomplices. You have to turn them into apostles. You turn back into apostles, they'll bring the material to the woman. They'll call her on the cell phone. That happens every day. We're talking to people, and it ends up that you give it to the other person, and they go back in, they talk, and they bring it back out. I had just a couple of days ago, I asked the fellow to go in and get her, you see? He did. And he said, oh, she won't do it. I said, go in. We'll pray, see? And when you do, when they go in and pray, you go over to the prayer group immediately. Tell them, pray. This person just gone in. Pray. See? Just keep the prayer group focused. That their prayers are very purposeful and meaningful. Okay? And they are. And so what happened is, she came back out, and the two of them enjoying, crying and laughing, and the whole nine yards. See? So everybody that comes is in need of counseling. So when you think of sidewalk counseling, do not think you're counseling the mother. You're not. You're counseling everybody who needs conversion that comes to that site. Okay? And everybody that works in there, your presence, prayerful, is converting them. After a while, if you don't say things to them, don't curse them, don't be kind and merciful and loving, after a while they're apologetic for going in and telling you, I got to get out of this hellhole. Matter of fact, that people come out to tell me, I'm out of the hellhole, Father. You see? This is what the reality is. So your prayerful presence is incredibly important. Now, let me say this. If a person has the abortion, what do you do? Well, you don't let them go. If you treated them with love and respect, and dignity. If a person's going in spite of everything they're saying, you don't become strident. You don't become condemnatory. You become more loving, more gentle, more trusting in God. It's not you anyway. See, if you do the job outside, 96% of the people that we turn around, the helpers turn around, actually go inside. Very few do we actually turn around on the sidewalk that they walk away. But if they experience a Christian approach, a Christian community, and love outside, and they go inside, and they're treated like someone in an assembly line, they're treated like someone that is, well, how are you going to pay for this? There can't be the Spirit of God in there. You cannot duplicate the Spirit on the sidewalk inside. Impossible, impossible. So, if you treat them with love and respect, when they come back out, they're not angry with you. They feel they've disappointed you. They feel that they've let you down. They let you down, you see? So what do? Well, this is very important. When people are come outside, including the accomplices, I call them, it's important that you, timing, not just what you say, how you say it, when you say it. Watch their body language. Notice when's the time to speak, when's not the time to speak, you see? When a mother comes back out, and she comes back out, and she's not afraid of us, she feels she disappointed us. She feels sad because of the loss, but she also knows experience, we were right. So if you go over to the gently, and you don't offer this to say, oh, don't do it next time. No, you don't do that. You don't do that. See, you offer this, a rosary. You go and you say, and by the way, the rosary is the most powerful means we have of turnarounds. Everybody knows that. We give rosary, we hang it in our hands, we give them to them, they take them, people of all faith and no faith, and when they take the rosary, we give them how to say the rosary, okay? This is from the Fatima in Washingtonville, the shrine. It's very beautiful. It has the 20 mysteries of the rosary, you see? It has the prayers, everything with it. And we give this to them with a pair of rosaries. These rosaries are blessed because we bless them there, but it's also by the people who made them, were praying, you see? So when the mother comes out, we go over to her, and very quietly, very gently say, may I give you a gift? She said, look, may I give you a gift? Because she, God loves her. I don't know. I know what she did was wrong. I don't know if she knew it was wrong until she did it. Big difference, understand? I say to you, some people, after they crucified Jesus, I am sure that night, all the people that were Golgotha at Calvary, they were all different reactions that night. The 12th station here in the chapel, if you look at it, you go up there, Jesus is crucified and everybody's leaving. And it's rather interesting to see the expressions on people's faces, like, my God, what have we done? What have we done? We've crucified our God. They could not have gone home. Because you got to remember, it was in the beginning of the week, everyone was rejoicing that Christ had come to Jerusalem, the Savior of the world, the King of Kings, and we crucified our God. The girl is a natural reaction. When you're pregnant, there's a joy, life. My God, I took that life, you see? I took that life. So when a woman comes out, and she comes out, I go to her with a pair of rosaries, and I simply say, may I give you a gift? She goes, I said, now put it in her hand, like this. A gift, see? And I say, Mother, if you pray, I tell them, if you pray, you never come back here again. If you don't pray, they probably will be back here again. And I know you don't want to come back here again. See that? I didn't even mention the word abortion. And she will say, you are right. You are right. See, no defenses are up now. She knows she's been taken. It's long enough from the time the womb was empty that it was hit it like a ton of bricks. Okay? Herself a pinch like that. And what happened is, I say to the mother, look, God is merciful. We do things that are wrong in our life, see? But God will forgive us. But we do have to change whatever brought you here. Whatever brought you here. Bishop Dale used to say to me, if a mother's sorry for an abortion, why don't you absolve her right away? I said, Bishop, it's not that easy. I said, Bishop, there's 10 commandments, not only There's the Ten Commandments of God, and the fifth commandment is usually the last one to go. And I have to motivate her to be sorry for the other nine, okay, before I can give her the absolution from the tenth, you see, or the fifth, whatever it is. So, but the thing is, it's the beginning of a conversion, a turning around, if God's people are there. Because when she comes out, her self-opinion, her sense of her importance is so low, she thinks that neither God nor man nor anyone could or should love her. And if she feels that those pro-lifers just condemn me, right, then we play right into their hands. Right? But if you are loving and gentle, she doesn't hate you, she feels she's disappointed you. See, so if she goes in, you don't become more distracted. Don't put, the blood will be upon you. You don't do that, you see. Oh no, you're playing right into the hands of the world. No. You say, please read it. We'll pray for you. We'll be here. Hmm? So when she comes back out, you are there. And you're there with the love of Christ, you see. And so what you're doing is, when she comes back out, you tell about God's love, God's mercy. Okay? And how, God's mercy and love, how, But no, God will forgive us, but we must change. We must be sorry, that's all. And that means whatever brought us here has to be changed. Whatever brought us here. Now, just at that point, I want to just do a little digression here. Post-abortion symptoms. Post-abortion symptoms, right? What does that mean? Why does this happen? Because we are a nation in denial. We are denying that there is a child being killed and there is a loss. And the person going in there is in a state of denial. Denying the reality, see? And after she does it, if she continues to deny the loss, she does not grieve. And when she doesn't grieve, then it results in changes in habits, personality, from eating disorders, from drinking, from opinion of herself being very low, etc., etc., etc. Okay? Those are the results of a denial of the fact of a loss. Got that? That's very important. Now, let me give you an example. If you had someone belonging to you, very close to you, and they got an opinion from the doctor that they had cancer, terminal, they came home and they told you that. So I can't believe this. They get another opinion. So you go get another opinion. Doctor says terminal. My God. So what do? You say, well, let's start in a vena. Let's start praying. So you're praying for a 9-day novena, 50 days, what it may be, okay? And at the end of the novena, you go to the doctor again. Comes back, terminal. Okay? So the first thing is a state of denial, disorientation. Then you go from that to bargaining with God. If we say this and do this, then it will not be there. Okay? And then finally it comes back, it's there. Now you can become angry. Why my mother? Why my husband? Why my son? And that guy across the street. God should take him, he's a rat. that's precisely why God's not taking him, because he's a rat. There are rats in heaven. He's got to shape up, okay? He's got to shape up before. But your husband's ready, you see? There's a difference. Okay, that's the reality of it, okay? So what happens is then people begin, all this period of time, people are giving you some sympathy, consolation. It's a very interesting thing. No one wants to go to heaven unless they're sick. Any volunteers today? And no one will allow us to go to heaven, our loved ones, unless we become very sick. Interesting. So as this disease progresses, then everybody's praying to God to take your loved one. And finally he does. And then you have the wake. And at the wake, everybody's giving you further consolation, helping to adapt to your new situation, consolation, so forth, so forth. So you go through this whole process. Now take a person, there's no situation. A person drops dead of a heart attack. There's no second opinions. There's no period of consolation. There's no going into bargain and denial. There's even into the wake. And so we used to run seminars for widow and widowers called After the Flowers Are Gone, for quick deaths. When they had to go through a period of grieving,
period agreement. We went in after the flowers had gone. They identified wicked immediately. See? Now I'll take another case. If a person, a loved one, takes their life, suicide, same as a heart attack, except that you're into the wake, you're gone, but now you have two things here, grieving, but also feeling guilty. You say, should I have seen it coming? Could I have said something? Was there something I should have done before this, etc., etc., etc.? You see, you start to eat yourself up. Now take the case of an abortion. It's the suicide without doubt. I caused it. Understand how painful this is? I caused it. And there is no consolation. No one gives you any consolation. There's no grieving allowed. It's a constitutional right. You did it yourself. What's your problem? Understand this? It is incredibly painful. It's absurd. It's absurd, see? So what happens is, you're not allowed to express grief. You're not allowed to admit this. What are you going to do? How am I going to handle this? It's impossible. So you're going to state a denial. They have post-abortion symptoms. Now, if you admit that it is a loss, then you have not only grief, you have the need for forgiveness. Will God forgive me? Will my child forgive me? Will I forgive myself? How about everybody that drove me to this when I should have been stronger and told to go to and stood with my child? Can I forgive them? Understand that? Not easy. Not easy at all. Not easy at all. See? So there is the forgiveness part. Not only admitting of the guilt, the grief, the loss, but then once you do that, how can I handle this forgiveness? First of all, the understanding of God is wrong in that they sense they feel God is vindictive. God will punish them. God will not forgive them. And I told you, God never stopped loving them. God never stopped loving them. They stopped loving God. Their unborn child who was with God never stopped loving the parents. Never. You don't have to convince the child. Like, what will I say to my child? Nothing. The child will throw you a party. Theologically. Okay? And God will, of course God never stopped loving you. In all eternity he knew this, and he made you, and he knew it, and he forgives you. You have to know to forgive yourself. You have to forgive yourself. But the thing is this, forgiving of others. Forgiving others. So in other words, the post-abortion symptoms are not the cause of the first abortion. They are the effect of the first abortion. Make that distinction clear. Post-abortion symptoms are not the cause of that first abortion. They are the effects of the first abortion, which could cause a second abortion. But they're not the cause of the first abortion. What is the cause of the first abortion? As again now, knowing the people to whom you're speaking, when they come, two women come, right? Both pregnant. One ends up choosing life and the other doesn't. How come? You said the same thing to both people. One chose life, one did not. Because there's a difference. One person could come from a loving family. One person could come from a situation where everybody's trying to encourage them. And it's very easy, that final encouragement, to do it right and follow through. Another may be coming from a situation that no one in that family is encouraging her. They're abusing her. She might have gone to child abuse. A thousand reasons. Everything in that background, dysfunctional family stuff that she has, is being brought to that site, to that spot. And so for her to forgive all of that which brought her to the abortion is not easy. It's not easy. And you have to understand that. This is the person you're speaking to. Now, you can do an awful lot if you may be the first one that's treating her with dignity, with respect, with love, with reverence in her life. And you're giving her, speaking the truth, and you're speaking it with love and with reverence, respect, that in itself, with God's grace, that she can respond to for the first time. Right? So even if she had the abortion, you have to be with her to help her to go through, remove the denial, allow her to grieve, and then the grief then results in, it has to have forgiveness. Assure the forgiveness of God and the child and others, and that she, like God, who came into a broken world, if she forgives the others, if she's not condoning what they did to her. Forgiveness is not condoning the evil being done to you. It simply says, I forgive, it's your problem now. You don't have to convince me to act, to change my heart. My heart's changed. It's your heart that needs to be changed. You see? That's very important. And you can only do that with the grace of God. And what you're encouraging you to do is to do that with God's help and God's grace. Right? So when you're out in the street, it's a holy, blessed word. But the more you know what you're about, what you're doing, see, the more you actually start to think and reflect and encourage, the more you can accomplish, and God will work through you. So when a person then receives this matter, we, with the pink one, we don't have ultrasound machines. Okay, we don't have ultrasound machines, so we do the next best thing. We give the 9 months of pregnancy. Because inside, they will tell them how many weeks they are. Why? Because that determines the price. That's why. And if you notice, so often people come out who have twins, they will come out and keep the children. That's because they will not show them this ultrasound machine unless it's twins. And they show them the sonogram in the case of twins because they're charging them twice the price. Because they're killing two babies. Therefore, that's the reason why they have to show them the ultrasound. But normally, if they show them the ultrasound picture, they're fired. They are let go immediately. They are not allowed. Matter of fact, even in the medical textbooks, it tells the people performing abortions, turn the ultrasound machine away so the person hearing the abortion cannot see it. See it. Amazing, you see? So we give them this, and they can look at it, okay? And they can look at it and see the 9 months development, because they are being told the amount of weeks that they are in the pregnancy. And what happens is this, the negative consequences, okay, refutatio, refuting of going the direction of having the child, it's in here. You can stress again the negative effects on their lives in terms of physical, psychological, emotional, spiritual. It's in the pamphlet again. And the pamphlet shows, like, the picture development of the child is positive. Where they can get help is right there on the front page. They're not alone. God is with them. People will help them, etc. You see? And on the bottom of it, we have post-abortion healing. We have the post-abortion healing. We have the Rachel's Helpers and the Sisters of Life programs that they have, they can call. So you point that out to the people when they come back out. You say to them, look, you see the bottom here. You can call. You can call. Okay, okay, I'm just going to conclude with this because we're going to get you up to adoration. Okay? This is a true story. There's a fellow brought a girl, big powerful guy, and he brought it to the abortion mill, and he told me if I said one word to her that I was history. I'm trying to, what does that mean? Oh, I'm just a simple man. What does it mean I'm history if I say one word, see? So he's just glaring at me, and I tried to get the material, but I saw him put the material in the garbage, you see? So he went inside, but they both were pretty nasty, to tell you the truth. And he came back out. And I know he's waiting for me to say the word to make me history. So I sort of there, and he's out there, and he lights up a cigarette. Now, as he's lighting up the cigarette, the group, John Foley and that whole crowd, they're over there praying. See, they're praying, and the Museum for Life is around the exhibit, see? And what the thing is now, you're timing, when to approach the person, very, very important. When the person comes out for a cigarette, right, please don't go rushing over to them, they'll throw away the cigarette, go back inside. Let them take a few good draws on the cigarette. Let the nicotine, narcotic, addiction kick in, you see? So that they won't throw it away. They'll listen to you get that cigarette, this last drag, you see, this type of thing. So you let him drag. Take it, you see? But you also let him look, see? He sees the people. He's taking the drag. He's looking at me. But then he starts to catch the picture of the unborn child, the head. We have that, the head, you see? Because that's where I want conviction. See? And so he sees the people praying. So I can see he's changing. Changing. His mentality is changing. The body language is telling me that. So I go over, and what I do is I go over to him, and I go by him. He's there right next to the wall, and I know if I say a word, I still may be history. So I go by him, and I sort of walk by him, okay? And he's looking. And I stop, I turn around, and I come back, and I walk by him again. I'm still a coward. So I do it again. We hit the darn thing. See, go back and forth. See, and now he's watching me. You see? It's the old pendulum effect, you know? See the old pendulum effect? See? It's like a tennis match. You see, you shouldn't be like a tennis match on the side. You know, that's crazy. I keep going like this. You see, like, but the old pendulum effect, see? And I'm going back and forth. See? Now, we're in no hurry out there. We don't need the 2:00, so I might as well just enjoy myself. So I go back over to him, see, and I go to him, and I stop, I turn around, I leave again. See, and at this point, he's, can't believe this. So then I go past him again, stop, come back. This time now, I go up to him, see, and I stop, see, I turn around, and I say to him, did you read this? And he says to me, I can't hear you. Will you speak louder? That is a guy that said, if I say a word on history, and he's begging me to speak louder. Okay? This is crazy. So I say to him, look, I say, young women come here, and there's real help for them. Okay? And if they find out later that there was help for them, then they're going to curse the people who stopped them from getting that help. Let me tell you now. See, I said, why don't you give this to her so she knows this help? I already know he threw it in the garbage. See? But now at this point, I know he's starting to change. I see the body language. He's watching the people praying. He seems like, what have I done? And he's praying there. And he says, what have I done? He looks at the material, the cigarette. Now, watch them on the outside. If they light up a cigarette, and they're watching what you're doing, how do you know that? Because the cigarette is burning and they're not puffing it. You see? Yes. Okay? This tells you they're preoccupied. If they're puffing away, they're just jerking something. But once you get them that they stop, that they don't even know the cigarette is in their hands, it's just burning. Now you got them. So watch the body language. Watch everything out there. See? So what happens is, he then says to me, I went over to him, and he said, my God, what have I done? What have I done? Because he looked at the materials, he saw it, and he said, what can I do? And I said, here, take these rosaries, and that's okay, my friend just got here. She's standing me up, go ahead and call her up. I said, take these rosaries, go inside and pray. So this big guy that wanted to make me history, he takes the rosaries, goes inside, and he's praying. He's in there for at least an hour and 15 minutes praying. And I went over to the prayer group immediately and said, Florian, get praying for her, please, okay? So he goes in. Meanwhile, she's gone downstairs. She's on the gurney being rolled in. See? And he comes back out. I said, where are you going? He said, I'm thirsty. I've got to get something to drink. I said, wait a second. I said, didn't they tell you? He said, what? I said, it's prayer and fasting. You can't have anything to drink. Go back inside. And he says, do I have to? I said, yes, you do. So he went back inside. And he was praying and fasting. God's truth. Can God fast? This is a true story. So what happened was, he's inside, praying and fasting, and she's rolled into the operating room on the gurney. Okay? She's like, and the other reason, he gets the grace. I can't do this. And she gets up and goes back out, gets dressed, and there's a big waiting room inside there. It's about the size of this room here. And she comes up through that door, and he's on the other side. And she comes out of, back up to the waiting room, and she doesn't know how to tell this guy he's going to kill her. You see? Because he knows how angry she was. So she comes up, and she puts her head down as she starts walking across the room towards him. And he said, oh my God, what have I done? What have I done? What have I done? And she came over to him, and she said very quietly, I can't do it. And he said, what? She said, I can't do it. And he said, thanks be to God. And he broke down crying and embraced her. That's God's truth, you see. And they both came out to tell me the story. That's what happened, you see. They came out. That's how I know the whole thing. And then they took everything. And there's down 3rd Avenue, 43rd Street. It's like, actually, it's 8 lanes on the ground, 8 lanes above. That's a danger. 3rd Avenue is very hard. A lot of traffic. But the two of them go right into the middle of 3rd Avenue, you see. And he stops in the middle of 3rd Avenue. And he stops and he turns around. And he holds the beads up, and he shouts back to me, This is a true story. Monsignor, you are right. Prayer and fasting works.